listened to a podcast with Sam Harris and what was this other guy's name? He was the Russian chess champion for the longest time.
Kasparov or no, Gary was ours.
Gary Kasparov, yes.
Kasparov.
Yeah. Kasparov is, you know, other than being a chess champion or whatever, he also understands Russian foreign policy,
right.
And he had a conversation about Vladimir Putin.
Okay.
And so they brought up a lot of points that I think were incredibly important and suspect regarding our election and our president-elect. So, at least to begin with, the first point that I kind of started thinking of to begin with was, like, shouldn't it be a little suspicious that Russia supports Donald Trump, or at least Vladimir Putin is not opposed to Donald Trump?
Sure. Well, you have to keep in mind that, Russia is not a ally of the United States. I don't consider them an enemy, but they are an adversary. They inhabit this uncomfortable middle ground where and they enjoy cloaking themselves in secrecy just for the hell of it, so it's difficult to pin them down even on the best day. So yeah, I think that we always have to keep in mind that Russia has its own interests. They are not the same as the United States. But at the other on the other end of the spectrum, I don't consider Russia having a personal relationship with the president to be an unmitigated bad thing either. Context is king here. So I think regarding the election that claims of Russian tampering are both misguided and overblown. And the reason for that is Russia, in the guise of the Soviet Union as it was before it collapsed, has tried to influence every single American election since the 1920s.
Yeah.
And it got really bad at times. I mean, if you've ever read about the 1968 election where the Democrats literally tore themselves apart in street fighting in the streets of Chicago, and the police fought the blacks, and the blacks fought the whites, and the white working class fought the students, and it was this roiling mass of every single divide in American culture coming to the fore. Yeah, it was 1968 was actually probably more divisive than 2016, but 2016 was the closest we've had to it yet, you know? And the KGB and the their counterintelligence unit, which I can't remember the acronym of, was very heavily involved in paying off different people and playing off different sides. And that was just kind of expected. All throughout the 70s that was the case, the 80s that was the case, except they had switched to being almost purely focusing on the Democrats because the Republicans after the 1970s had kind of become enamored with neo-reactionism and with the advent of Reagan, and they've continued on to this day. And Russia kind of realized that they were going to be so jingoistic that there wasn't any headway, so they've been focusing on that ever since. And yeah, there was, you know, until probably the early 90s, that was just the fact of life that Russia and China were trying to manipulate U.S. elections. But that also holds for other, you know, for other groups as well. I mean, when you have in 2004, when Bush was up for re-election, and you had, you know, newspapers like Le Monde in France and that were, you know, actively trying to convince people to vote against Bush, that this is not in the interests of France to have Bush as president again, but you didn't get that same kind of hysterical knee-jerk reaction as you have from now. And I think the reason is because now the Democratic National Committee has been under fire. For Bush, Le Monde was trying to appeal to the Democratic National Committee to stop this mad neo-reactionary, stop this white male motherfucker. And Bush was a horrible president, don't get me wrong. It wasn't like Le Monde was being facetious and saying he was a bad president. They were entirely right. It's just who they were appealing to, which is the same people now that are calling, hacks, when, you know.
Yeah.
Russia has hacked a lot of U.S. shit. The electric grid gets penetrate testing every single day. China is one of the biggest, China is the biggest culprit, but Russia's a very close second. But as far as the U.S. election, I'm not convinced. Particularly because when you talk about Russian hacks, what do you actually mean? You know, there were five or six different computer stories, mm-hmm. to put it broadly, related to Clinton. The first one was about her email, you know, mm-hmm. scandal, which had nothing to do with Russia. This was an entirely domestic matter. And it was only the fact that she basically had no security on her private email mm-hmm. server that allowed other foreign intelligence services to penetrate it. Now, I guarantee you yeah. that Russia has her emails and China has her emails yeah. and Iran has her emails. I yeah. wouldn't be surprised if non-powers like Mexico had her emails, because there literally was no security.
Yeah.
But that's not Russia hacking. That's Russia basically being like, I can't believe she... Really? She did? Okay. And then just... It'd be the same thing if, yeah. if like the Russian minister for Gazprom, who... And Gazprom is their national oil syndicate, and their slush fund pays for a bunch of just evil shit that Russia mm-hmm. does. If he left his BlackBerry in Washington, D.C., and the CIA picked it up, that's not the CIA being really good spies. That's the CIA basically trying not to drown in their own jizz as they realize that they've just gotten handed the biggest, you know, intelligence breakthrough they're going to get yeah. that year. That's all that happened. When you talk about the DNC leaks, that wasn't Russia either. That was that was an insider. The CIA has openly said, "Hey, we don't have any proof that Russia went into the DNC and did that." The DNC then accused the GOP of getting hacked, and the GOP was like, "No, we haven't," and then gave up all of their logs that showed that there was no penetration testing. Now, the GOP did get hacked, but it was really, really early in the election mm-hmm. cycle, back when there were still like 16 people up there,
yeah.
and this was before the DNC even tried to collude with the media to try and shape things to get Donald Trump to be the nominee, because they thought he could beat him. And they were wrong on every single one of those counts, mm-hmm. but regardless of what they were colluding to do, Russia was nowhere involved, which brings us back to the fact that it's the DNC and their cronies that are now casting about for, oh, who we can blame, and it's like, blame Russia.
Sure.
And so it just seems ridiculous to me that they could, which doesn't change the fact that Russia is an adversary of the United States,
mm-hmm.
and that I don't think that Trump is going to be the bulwark, you know, guarantor of American security hand in hand with his good buddy Putin that some people honestly believe he's going to be. Do you know who Silvio Berlusconi was?
Sure.
Is okay. Berlusconi was prime minister of Italy for like 12 years, and the guy was just corrupt as all hell. Like, he was a media personality, he's very flamboyant, likes hot women, had four wives, has a bunch mm-hmm. of kids. He's basically Italian Donald Trump, mm-hmm. with better suits and even less hair. And he gained the prime ministership of Italy and held on to it for the longest time, basically by playing all sides off against himself, and whenever he put his foot in his mouth, he just opened his mouth wider, said some other dumb shit, and magically got away with it. Like, his ability mm-hmm. to just out-bullshit his way out of just about anything mm-hmm. was legendary. And he was not a good thing for the Italian economy. He wasn't a bad thing, but he was out for Berlusconi. He wasn't out for himself. And he rode to power on a wave of populist anger, and he left with even more populist anger simmering under the surface that's now popped out in things like the Five-Star Movement and the no vote on the referendum. But I think Putin sees Trump as an American Berlusconi.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he's wrong in that regard. I mean, I've never considered Trump to be all that great of an option. I considered Hillary to be worse, which is why I voted for him. But, I mean, please don't mistake my vote for him as some stunning, you know, the whole Make America Great Again thing was marketing at its pure best, but it was reality distorting on its face. And I think everybody knew that. I think that most Trump voters knew that. I don't think that most Trump voters were as dumb or as deplorable as people think they are. They just saw that their options were between more of the same, which is indelibly and knowingly fucking them over, mm-hmm. or maybe not doing that.
Yeah.
And so when you have that choice, you choose maybe not doing that. But the only person I think that doesn't realize this at the moment is Trump himself, because mm. Trump is caught between all of these. His voice is whoever he's heard from that day.
Mm.
And the GOP, the neo-reactionary, neo-conservative, mm. you know, hard right, the same type of people who just ruined Bush's presidency, have realized that Trump is going to be president, and now they're angling to become his cabinet as much mm-hmm. as possible. That scares me more than Trump himself being in office.
Yeah.
And so I think Trump, or excuse me, I think Putin is going to try and exploit that, and I think Trump is going to fall for it for about 2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
And what's interesting to me, and what kind of worries me, is in the future, what happens when Trump realizes that that's how Putin sees him? Because I have absolutely no idea how Trump is going to react to that. Mm. I have absolutely no idea what he's going to do. I don't think he's just going to take it lying down. Which is effectively what Obama's been doing now that his foreign policy vis-a-vis pretty much all of his disagreements with Putin has failed.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just interesting. But, I mean, you know, Putin is old-school KGB.
Yeah.
His worldview is just diametrically opposed to the type of people who traditionally inhabit the power circles in Washington. Have you ever heard the acronym WEIRDOS or the weird people? It stands for... Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. Or weird. Weirdos. Obama's basically the poster child for being a weird kid.
Mm.
You know, he's an effete, posh, Ivy League lawyer academic who was, you know, basically elected to be the ante. Who would you rather have a beer with? George Bush, and won the Nobel Peace Prize because basically he was black and not Bush.
Yeah.
And that's the exact type of person, this bubble, that has destroyed the majority of Americans' faith in U.S. government and has also just been run roughshod over by everybody from Iran to China to Putin. And I don't know. I mean, I say Putin like he's the arbiter of everything Russian, and he's not, but he is the arbiter of everything Russian government at the moment. You know, you can talk about Russia in terms of Putin to a much larger degree than you can talk about America in terms of Trump.
Sure.
However much Milo Yiannopoulos hates that, but it's true. You know, it's very true. So, that's kind of a rambling preliminary. I'm kind of getting my thoughts in order. But you had some specific questions about Russia and about.
I think another thing is that one big point that seems important to me, I think, is maybe the change in sentiment between, especially on the conservative side, the acceptance of Vladimir Putin now. That, you know, they're comparing Donald Trump to Ronald Reagan, and, I mean, Ronald Reagan was tear down this wall, so...
Right.
It's kind of dumbfounding to think that... you know, that it, in one extreme we have this, like, oh, we have to pull back the Iron Curtain, but on another aspect, now we have Donald Trump being like, let's be friends.
Right. It is kind of ironic that now the people who are crying about Russia and having to take on Russia and having to be strong against Russia are the Democrats?
Mm-hmm.
Like, wake me up when 2016 ends, bruh. Like, I understand.
There have been flips.
No, there have been. I mean, the first president to commit U.S. troops to fighting the Soviets was Uber Democrat Woodrow Wilson back in 1919. You know, so I mean, it's the problem with American foreign policy as viewed domestically is that America has interests that transcend political parties, but we always see our politics in the lens of whoever is controlling the White House at the moment. America has interests that are diametrically opposed to that of Russia, and those are immutable because those are based on national character, national race, geography, economics, history, and those things change very slowly, if at all.
Mm-hmm.
Our political system, by world standards, changes really, really quickly, superficially.
Yeah.
One level down, it never changes at all, and that's part of the reason why we're having such trouble right now, but superficially, we go through these mood shifts back and forth and back and forth. And that is very difficult for Russians to conceive of. Russia will always choose to be secure before it chooses to be democratic.
Sure.
That's something that more than 1,000 years of history has informed the Russian character of. You are never going to be Russian is to be surrounded by people who don't like you. They are perennially stuck in, whether it's true or not, but it's true more often than we want to admit that Russia has a point here. They are stuck in a rather bad end of the neighborhood, geographically. And Russia does not have very many easily defensible borders. The borders of Russia are generally very open.
Yeah.
And whether you're a horseman belonging to Genghis Khan, or a panzer commander belonging to Hitler, or a dragoon scouting for Napoleon, or a Polish lancer, or a Swedish soldier belonging to the army of Charles XII, or if you're a Turk belonging to the Ottoman Empire, all of these people have shown up on Russian land and gone, this looks fucking great. I wonder how far we can go here. And the answer is generally until Russia bleeds you out and brings the border back.
Yeah.
And so Russian history... for 1,000 years here has been this history of their borders being bloodlands, where the border was kept in place because of the suffering Russia was willing to go to keep those borders. And that was true even when the Soviet Union, which really was the Russian mindset on steroids, there was nothing ever international about the Soviet Union, at least not past the immediate aftermath of the Russian Civil War. Like, the counter-revolutions that took place when Lenin died and then Stalin took over and killed off all of the old Bolsheviks who were, you know, multicultural to the core. I mean, we had Jews and ethnic Germans and ethnic Georgians and ethnic Russians and Ukrainians and Poles and a couple of Japanese thrown in there because, fuck it, we border them. And they all got killed. And then it was just... from about 1928 to the for the next 60 some years, it was just basically an ideologically different Russian empire. And a large part of their expansionism was in part due to wanting defensible borders. And that includes places like Ukraine. That includes places like the Baltics, which they really don't see as legitimate because they've been ruled by Russia for longer than they've been independent in total since, like, the Middle Ages. Which is not to say I agree with them, but I mean, like, you know, the Russian mindset is basically if you're on the back foot, people are going to come and kick you when you're down, so you might as because you're going to get hated anyways. So you might as well. And we're not helping them in that respect. I mean, when Russia collapsed in the 1990s, this was not as traumatic an event as a collapse in America would be for us.
Yeah.
Because Russia had already been completely hollowed out and completely atomized socially by the pernicious effects of communism and autocratic rule. And so it was, I mean, things had already collapsed on the ground but by the time the Soviet Union was like, all right, roll it in, boys, put the different flag out. We got, and the real horror for them was that it reinforced in their minds that when you collapse, the world feasts on you. Because when Germany collapsed, when Germany collapsed, when we literally overran them and Russia overran them and we divided it down the middle, we gave them the Marshall Plan. And when we nuked Japan, we gave them, you know, the MacArthur Plan, and we rebuilt both of them. When the Soviet Union collapsed, we were no longer a social democracy. We had now transitioned over to market fundamentalism. So rather than the Marshall Plan, we gave them the shock doctrine. And we feasted upon Russian industry, and we basically bled them dry for the natural resources for the next 10 years. From 1991 to the early 2000s, when Putin really took over and destroyed the oligarchs as an independent source of power. And that 10 years was more traumatic than just collapse in and of itself for the Russian mindset. And so you're never going to convince a Russian that was alive or was a child of one of the people that was alive then that it's better to be a partner than it is to basically just fuck off, we're going to do our own thing. And that was, to my mind, about 40% our fault. About 40% of it was just, your country collapsed, bro. Like, you're going to have a bad time anyways. And about 20% of it was just vagaries. If the Chechen wars weren't as horrible as they were, then maybe that would have changed a little bit. If NATO hadn't been begged as hard, you know, if the other Eastern European countries had handled it better, wanting to go as pro-Western as they were, then that would have handled it a little bit better. Because, I mean, from the Russian mindset, they woke up under Putin, who for the first time in a decade was now a strong ruler who was capable of getting what he wants, and if the Russian people would unite behind him, they could have a better life. They looked out and they saw from Finland to the Baltics to Poland to Ukraine, down into Georgia, and then around to the other side into the stands, and then into Japan on the other side, all of these countries that were cooperating with the United States. And it was Russia's geopolitical nightmare come true. They're fucking surrounded. Like, literally got, you know, honest to God, surrounded. And it just, there's a bitterness and a fear and a desperation in the Russian mindset that is never going to go away. There's a paranoia there that is, in all too often, tragically, in history, justified.
Yeah.
And that's not what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
The United States is not the Mongol Empire. But Russia would always rather be safe than sorry. And so from that mindset springs Russian foreign policy. This fear of being surrounded, this willingness to do whatever it takes to protect Russia. As they see it, Russia extends far beyond the geopolitical borders of Russia now.
Yeah.
And now I can wait. And that's where the vagaries of it. It's a completely separate mindset from the West. Because Russia is not the West. Mm-hmm. Russia has always looked to the West for inspiration in good times, and it despises it mm-hmm. in bad times. It's just close enough to get a taste and just far enough away that it's never going to get a full seat at the table.
Sure.
And it's always been a little bit irked by that. You can also say the same thing for places like the Baltics or Poland, maybe, or Ukraine. It's just far enough away. Once you get east of the Balkans, things get weird mm-hmm. when you start judging things based on Western precepts. And I think it honestly would be easier for the United States and even places like England to work with Russia better if Russia didn't look so much like us. Like, if Russia looked Asian, if Russia looked Mongolian, it'd be a lot of disagreements that would be much easier to smooth out, because I think a lot of American diplomats really honestly believe that we can just have a good faith dialogue between the Russians, because goddammit, we're just two white guys sitting at the table, and that's not the case.
Yeah.
That is not the case. And Russia will exploit that every time.
Yeah.
So that's to set the stage, that's Russia is a paranoid, geographically surrounded state that knowledge permeates everything that Russia does as a state. But they were using that, and they weren't being effective in the 90s. So the question is then, what changed with the advent of Vladimir Putin, and what changed mm-hmm. in what they were doing over the past, let's say, 15 years that got them in the position now where they're making deals in the Middle East and cutting America out entirely?
Yeah.
And they're working with China instead of fighting them like they did 50 years ago. Yeah. You know, what gives? And so that really is the meat of the discussion.
I think that, like, you kind of mentioned how Vladimir Putin, sort of tried to get rid of the, oligarchs and stuff, but at the same time that, I'm not sure how open Russia is to working with Trump, but Trump
sure.
is obviously open to working with Putin. But I mean, given that Putin, did take control from the oligarchs in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
How does that speak towards working with the epitome of the oligarch now?
Sure.
In Donald Trump.
Well, Putin did not destroy the oligarchs. Putin destroyed the oligarchs as an independent source of power. And there's a difference there. The people who ran Russia in the 90s were the people who were most vociferous about literally selling out every other part of Russia in order to get access to newly released global finance.
Mm.
And these, I mean, they were called the oligarchs for a reason. These were largely middle management guys who, under Glasnost and Perestroika and the last gasps of the Soviet Union, realized that the global economy and everything that was going to come rushing in was just an unstoppable tide. It was going to come one way or another, and they just wanted to position themselves to take control of it. A lot of these guys were really well-meaning in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But then when everything opened up and the Soviet Union became politically incapable of holding back that tide, mm-hmm. the knowledge slowly spread that it was like, bruh, we can do whatever we want.
Yeah.
And then human nature took over, and it just became a spiral system from there. When Putin took over, that was basically a counter-revolution.
Mm.
Putin is KGB.
Sure.
His followers are either, or his inner circle are either military dudes or their fellow intelligence guys.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was a coup not from the Russian people, because they were powerless and impoverished. This was not from the Russian army, because they are drawn from the Russian people. This was a counter-coup from the Russian deep state, a last desperate attempt to save what they saw as Russia as an entity from being torn apart
mm-hmm.
by outside, and so when they went after the oligarchs, this was done vindictively, and this was done with an enormous amount of cruelty involved
mm-hmm.
with what happened to some of these guys. But Russia also realized that things had changed on the ground. You were never going to be able to put back as strong of a state as what happened under the Soviets. And so they didn't try to.
Mm-hmm.
Part of Russia's success is that, and I told you this in texting back and forth, mm-hmm. part of Russia's success is that by necessity, because they've already collapsed and they see themselves as a post-collapse state, they have to keep in mind
mm-hmm.
their weaknesses and their strengths, and they have to have a very accurate measurement
mm-hmm.
of, so basically, they know that they don't have the biggest dick in the room anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And they're okay with that, because now it's all about how they use it.
Yeah.
And they, by necessity, had to get very, very good at doing that. Now, also, the cultural and geopolitical things come into play here. Russia, or excuse me, the Soviet Union had the, I mean this when I say this, the most aggressive hard sciences educational system in the world for most of its existence.
Yeah.
Even the stereotypically engineering Germans were shocked when they invaded places like Belarus and Ukraine in 1941 and 42, when they were like seeing the, you know, the physics and the Newtonian calculus that the Soviet Union were teaching to grade schoolers and middle school level people. I mean,
yeah.
And so when you have all of, when you have that caliber of people, and you've got a nation that is far above the average in terms of computer engineers and software engineers and computer scientists and hard mathematicians and physicists, and you're suddenly in a position where there's no legitimate way for them to make money, now you start having an enormous amount of criminality. Mm-hmm. And so not only the oligarchs selling secrets, but the mob selling anything.
Yeah.
And so when we talk about the Russian state, Russia is not a Russia's not a state anymore in the classic Westphalian sense. They're too weak for that. You know, they've got the GDP of Mexico, but they spend like 5 to 6% of their GDP per year trying to prop up and modernize a military.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting smaller and smaller every year because they're still working their way through a demographic trough because Russian women stopped having babies because they were poor. And the things that they do have, though, are things like the Russian mob.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Russian mob, when they want to hire a computer hacker, they don't have to hire somebody. They are the computer hacker.
Yeah.
You know, these are guys who, a lot of them, have served in the intelligence services, have served in the military. They've got master-level degrees or certifications in computer science or economics or whatnot. And they are patriotic in the ethnic sense, meaning that they're like Slavic nationalists,
sure.
A lot of them. Not all of them, but a lot. And so Russia uses them as what's called patriotic hackers. Well, you'll see this all over in that the coalition that Russia patched together in the late 90s and early 2000s was this amalgamation of enough state centrality to make the whole thing work and then basically opportunistically using the centers of powers where they lay to try and further Russian governmental interests. And this goes back to the oligarchs. The oligarchs no longer have the ability to unilaterally decide what's best for Russia. But they do have very deep pockets, and they're able to do things like the business of so-and-so will go and fund a hacker room in Belarus to go and hack into the U.S. Electrical grid. Well, when the U.S. responds, they're going to find a bunch of nebulous hackers that don't work for the Russian government, and they're going to trace their servers back to either Belarus or maybe Kaliningrad or maybe Poland, wherever they've been bought. And then when they trace back, you know, where any cash flow is coming from, it's coming from a Russian business, and maybe the businessman has been fired from the company to go and live in a dacha somewhere for plausible deniability. It's like an onion layer. There's like four or five levels. Whereas for the United States, we're still so fucking centralized. Like if the president is like, go hack back Russia, then that gets passed off to the director of intelligence, who then directs it to U.S. Cyber Command, and then the Cyber Command, calls up his Air Force Headquarters Command, and it's transferred to like the 1,277th Information Decryption Squadron at Fort Meade, Maryland, with its own Facebook page, and you can pull up the commander on Google LinkedIn, or Google Plus, or LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And In cyber warfare, it's much more asymmetric. Russia, in many ways, is better than us at cyber war.
It's very interesting to think that Russia, the so-called communist unified state, is so good at decentralizing their hacking efforts, whether it be through orders of Vladimir Putin or just some oligarch that. Even in the U.S. being all free market and
and I think that, I mean, in the aftermath of the Cold War, I think hard distinctions or hard useful distinctions between what is leftist and what is rightist are just becoming more and more relevant. I don't think that could be any further. I don't think that could be any more usefully shown than pretty much all of 2016, where now you have the Democrats, which are really proxies for the status quo. Screaming about Russia hacks, and then you've got the Republicans who are trying to be taken over by a proto-insurgency by the name of Donald Trump, screaming about Putin's my friend. And Russia's tried to make a virtue out of necessity here. Mm-hmm. Russia's always going to be more decentralized than the United States is until the United States collapses. And then it's up to us to see whether we're going to make a virtue out of necessity. And so Putin is a strong man in the sense that he has fought really hard and used all of his assets to get the bedrock of power in Russia under his control. Everything else exists in orbit around him, and people can compete to see how close to the orbit they can get. But people do have the ability to kind of spin off and do their own thing, and then Russia tries to either, with, you know, both carrot and stick, bring them back into line of what the Kremlin wants.
I guess going back to that initial question, what do you think the future is of affairs with Russia regarding Trump especially?
Okay. Russia is, for the past 15 years now, building up to and has now has begun to be much more aggressive than what Westerners would be if you just plopped them into the Kremlin seat. And the reason for that is because Russia knows they're going to collapse again. Demographics, not only of themselves but of their surrounding countries, economics, resource flows, means that if the collapse is not going to be as spectacular as the one in the late 80s and early 90s, it is going to be a stair-step fashion that is going to render Russia largely incapable of improving its situation here from about 10 to 15 years in the future, lasting indefinitely, nobody knows how long. And so from Russia's point of view, they're trying to carve out as much as they can because, again, to be Russian is to be surrounded. They're going to try their damnedest to not be in the weakest position possible because they don't trust anybody else to not take advantage of their weakness.
Well, at this point, they've been gearing up their propaganda to be as much anti-American and as it can possibly be. And that, according to Garry Kasparov, almost worse than in the Cold War.
Right. Part of that is because the internet makes alternative media a lot easier. See, in the 1950s, in order to get the same type of penetration Russia currently does now, they would have to have basically taken over a major U.S. media corporation. Mm-hmm. To do that now, all you have to do is make sure everybody in the United States has internet connection and then just spam fake news. Or whatever we're calling it nowadays. And this is part of what I was talking about several months ago when I was talking about the gradual breakdown of the nation state, that it's becoming impossible technologically and sociologically for these uber-centralized states to retain control of the narrative. Because part of what Russia does is – part of what Russia says is true. Part of what this says is outright lies. Most of it is just in the middle and they just sling bullshit, see what works, and then double down on that. And again, this is a decentralized process. You've got Russian government-funded corporations like Russia Today. You've got patriotic news organizations like Southfront.org, which takes some money from the Russian government, takes some money from donations, many of which come from abroad, and exist almost entirely online and navigate already anti-American or anti-American status quo organizations and then use them for their advantage. Russia's strategy is basically – They have seen that the post-Cold War world is cracking. And they are trying to slither into all of the gaps and break them open further. To that end, things like the refugee crisis in Europe are windfalls that Putin runs with 24/7. Every hour of the day and every day of the year. This gets even into deep cultural things as well. Like, Russia's always going to be more conservative than France is. You know, France is a maritime power that has a liberal tradition going back several hundred years. Russia is primarily a land power that's surrounded by neighbors and fights wars very, very regularly in defense of its territorial integrity. You know, I mean, they're always going to be more reactionary. I'm not even going to say conservative. They're always going to be more reactionary than the French are. And so when you have large amounts of immigrants coming in, Russia kind of gloats at that.
It's kind of funny because, like, every once in a while I'll, like, glance over at this map that you have hang up in your living room, and I'm like, hey, look, like, the so, like, every once in a while I'm, like, able to, like, pinpoint exactly where you're talking about and go, like, yes, I see that. But, sorry, so, I mean, what angle is a possibility for the future? Are they going to cooperate with the U.S., or are they just going to, like, buckle down and say no?
It really kind of depends. Russia wants three things. Russia wants a strategic bubble, a sphere of influence around itself, And it wants to make it as large as possible, but primarily the reason for that is that it wants to make sure that it can be taken advantage of. If we can show that we truly understand the Russian mindset and we can make hard, independently verifiable deals with Russia that show that we're not going to repeat the market fundamentalists of the past, that we repudiate that just as much as the Russians hate that, then I think that you'd be surprised how willing the Russians would be to just strike hard bargains and say, okay, fine, we'll leave Poland alone, but just don't fuck with Belarus, or okay, fine, we won't try and freeze the conflict in Ukraine indefinitely, we just want regional autonomous zones in East Ukraine, which are primarily Russian ethnic anyways. Okay, fine, we'll start paying for Crimea again, just stop sending intelligence to the Turkish Navy. Well, it just doesn't matter.
There's a conflict there because, I mean, it makes sense that you're saying that Russia is willing to make these hard deals, but at the same time, Donald Trump is not a good deal maker. He makes deals that benefit him only.
True. The biggest problem I have with Trump being in charge of foreign policy is that the thing that works best with American foreign policy is things like the Monroe Doctrine or a thing like the Truman Doctrine, where we lay out very general, broad overviews of here is what we want, and then regardless of what comes onto our plate, we filter it through that and then discover, okay, how can we work towards this, whereas not. Donald Trump is literally flying by the seat of his pants.
Yeah.
Every single day he wakes up, he just checks Twitter, shit posts, and then goes on and does whatever he wants. That's literally how he's going to run the presidency. And so Trump is not – there's going to be no Trump doctrine that whoever follows Trump can click into like Eisenhower did for Truman and go, okay, so we've got this – you know, we're gonna you know, contain Soviet or communist expansion and we're going to live with them, but we're not going to let them get any further and we're just going to let them, you know, bleed themselves out economically, which is exactly what happened. Trump is not going to be that guy.
Yeah.
But domestically – Hillary Clinton wasn't going to be that girl either. All she wanted to do was just double down on the reactionary Russia bad, push them back bullshit, which was going to push Russia to the wall. That's never good.
Yeah.
And so what we need is a reorganization of American domestic politics so that we can get a hard reorganization of what are American interests. You know, if you ask the average person trying to craft policy, I say average person, there's no such thing as an average person who crafts policy for the American government. Therein lies one of the problems. But if you were to ask, you know, an advisor or even a senior decision maker, what are America's interests in Syria? And I think that we do have a couple of interests in Syria, but it'd be very difficult to get the same answer from all of them. What are America's interests vis-a-vis Ukraine versus Russia? Because Russia can answer those.
Yeah.
They've got those down. They've had those down since the 1950s, and those have not changed. And so when Russia's coming at us with very hard, objective reasons for why they do things and we don't, that's exactly why Russia can just run circles around us. So the first thing we need to change is us. So that we can then come to Russia and say, here's what we want. And Russia goes, well, here's what we want. And we can say, well, hey, those don't conflict.
Yeah.
So here, where's the compromise? But therein lies the problem is because, you know, the people who control the U.S. government, they're out for themselves. You know, the Hillary Clinton is just as much of an oligarch as Donald Trump is.
Exactly.
She's just not as brazen about it.
Yeah.
You know, the Koch brothers and George Soros and most of Congress – and the revolving door between finance and Washington and defense contractors, they do not have the best interests of the United States people at heart. For all of Putin's faults, for all of his immense corruption, for all of his authoritarianness, he has improved the lives of the Russian people. And it's that base level of basically make me your king and I will save you ness that Russia is always very comfortable with, and that gives him the ability to have 80% approval ratings. I refuse to believe that it's just Putin outlawing people who speak out against him that gives him that high of an approval rate. I guarantee you that's part of it. You know, I mean, he'd probably be in the 60s or, you know, about 2/3 of Russians agreeing with him. But think about it. When was the last time a president left office with anything above a 50% approval rating?
I don't know.
It was the first term of Bill Clinton.
Nice.
It has not been this millennium when we've had that, because we are such a divided nation. We're ruled by basically a tribe atop a divided nation who's pursuing their own ends, regardless if you're a liberal in the East Coast or a liberal in the West Coast, and there is a difference, or a conservative in the middle, or a conservative on the coast or a liberal in the middle. It doesn't matter. They're not listening to you.
Yeah.
And And they're not bettering you either. See, the difference in Russia is that the Russian elite aren't listening to the people, but they are bettering them.
Mm-hmm.
And Russia, the Russian people, by and large, are willing to make that. And so the primary thing that America needs to do is stop treating this like we already have all of our ducks in a row, and if we just beat Russia over the head enough, they're just going to give up and go home. They're not. The reason they're not going to is because they recognize that we don't have our ducks in a row.
Yeah.
Our foreign policy is in shambles. Our domestic economy has not recovered from 2008. Mm-hmm. We're completely divided ideologically. We're replacing ourselves demographically, and that's going to lead to reactionary shit all over the spectrum as that happens.
And they called our bluff.
They did, because we don't have anything to back that up.
Yeah, well, you know? Explain real quick what happened in Crimea for the people that...
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I exist in such a wonky thing. So there's two areas in foreign policy that Russia completely called our bluff, and we came up not even holding... It wasn't like we had aces. We didn't have anything.
Mm-hmm.
The first was in Crimea, and the second was in Syria. Mm-hmm. So Ukraine used to be completely controlled by the Soviet Union, and then in the 1950s, as basically an interior reorganization... the Soviet Union was like, fuck it, yeah, we'll make Ukraine independent, because you guys know what that means, right?
Yeah.
And then everything fell apart 30 years later, and now Ukraine suddenly was birthed prematurely into the world and just kind of existed as this proto-mafia state for them. But Crimea is this little peninsula at the bottom of Ukraine. It's basically Ukraine's ball sack, and it's where the Russian Navy exists in the south. Russia's a very cold place, so the only warm water port they had year-round was Crimea. And this also means that anytime Russia felt like they needed to put up their dukes and try and fight or pretend that they were capable of fighting anybody to the south of them, and this includes everybody from the United States to Europe to Turkey, and Turkey and Russia have fought constantly for 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
It relied in large part upon the Russian Black Sea Fleet based out of Sevastopol on the peninsula of Crimea. So, Crimea is now majority Russian. You know, when you retire out of the Black Sea Fleet, you get yourself a little dacha that you don't have to pay much for because you know the commander and he gives it for free because you served the same sub back in the 60s. That's the way everything works over there. And it's like 85% like literally born in Russia and now living in Crimea. But it's not really part of Ukraine, but like legally it was. And it's that difference between international law and the way things actually happen. And Russia will always pick the latter over the former anyways. So when Ukraine had their little revolution in 2013, which was basically just against corruption, Russia took the opportunity that Ukraine was now weak to pounce on them, which ironically was the exact same thing that the West did against Russia in the 1990s, but Russia is never going to see it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so they started splitting off the ethnic Russian parts of the East in order to keep Ukraine paralyzed and therefore not go over towards NATO. And they also just straight up took over Crimea because, hey, we were already there anyways, and fuck you, we need our Black Sea Fleet.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that. And the United States was like, no, you can't do this. And Ukraine was like, or what? And the United States was like, yeah, I'll get back to you on that. We just never have. Because we had no idea what we were actually trying to do in Ukraine. Ukraine is a mafia state. Ukraine is one of the most corrupt places in Eastern Europe. We tried to go in there and fix shit. They stole all our money and ran. We fired all those people. Now, keep in mind, I am saying the United States literally fired representatives of another foreign government. This literally happened. Fired those people, brought in new people, gave them more money. They took that money and ran.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're paralyzed because our allies on the ground don't do what we want them to do. And this is a perennial American problem because we honestly do tend to believe that if we just believe hard enough, everybody's going to turn into an American. And it's not true. And that thought's been pervasive in the 20th century, but that thought literally controls the U.S. government now. Mm-hmm. There's no Nixon waiting in the wing so that when everything fucks up, he can go and inject some real politic into this. Trump's definitely not that guy.
Yeah.
And so Ukraine just fell to smithereens. Ukraine's tried to build it back together. They put up a plucky defense against literal Russian invasions there. They're trying their best. The Ukrainian people are tired of corruption, but it's the same 52 deck of faces that turn up in Ukrainian politics anyways because they have all the money because they had their oligarchic thing in the 90s. And the whole thing's a shambles, and the United States has no idea what it actually wants to accomplish there. Russia does. So even though Russia's dick is like a third the size of ours, they know how to use it, and they're the only ones juicing all over Ukraine's face right now. In Syria, it's almost the exact same thing. Assad is a brutal dictator. The civil war began because he tortured a bunch of kids to death for writing bad things about him. I'm not making that up, by the way. And the whole thing just turned into this clusterfuck of the whole region breaking apart on religious and ethnic and ideological and economical lines. And it's not going to end anytime soon, whether in Syria or in any rest of the part of the Middle East. But Russia had only one goal. And that was keep Assad in power. We don't care if he rules the whole country. We don't even care if the borders exist like they did before the war began. Just so long as Assad's in power, and he can throw us bones about you know, bases in Syria, or, you know, making sure that we can make life hell for American allies in the region, we'll do whatever we want. Mm-hmm. And we don't care about civil rights, and we don't care about any of that. It's very, very simple. America strode into there with absolutely no goddamn idea what we were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we still don't.
Yeah.
And so when chemical weapons started getting used in the summer of, or late summer of 2013, Obama, in his typical weirdo fashion, stood up for human rights in the American way and said, this is a red line. We are going to, if you use chemical weapons, that's going to be it. America's going to do something. Yeah. And when Arabs hear America's going to do something, they think of Iraq in 2003.
Yeah.
And so this was literally like, oh shit, like, you know, and then more stuff got used, and everybody looked at Obama, and Obama looked at everybody else, and nothing happened. Now, ideally, behind the scenes, this is what I think happened. Obama, for all of his weirdo-ness and all of his out of touch with 90% of Americans, is not a neoconservative. He is a neoliberal in the just put the good people in charge and fuck most of the country and we know what's better for you type, just infuriating way that makes me despise the man. But he is not an invade the world, make the world safe for America type of person. So at least he's smarter than George Bush in that respect. Mm-hmm. But when the United States got involved in Libya, that wasn't Obama, that was Hillary Clinton and the rest of the residual neocons left over saying, hey, it'll be fine, we're not going to do it like Iraq, it's just going to be airstrikes, it's going to be fine, bro, it's just a prank. And then that didn't work. And so when they said it again 2 years later, Obama had a really come-to-Jesus moment in the White House where it was literally Hillary Clinton and the State Department yelling, do it, do it, do it, just do it,
yeah.
And he decided against it. But that made him look really, really weak because he had already said, with smug backing up from Hillary Clinton, we're going to make this a red line, and then it just completely fell apart. So when the United States, after failure in Iraq and quagmire in Afghanistan, says this is a red line and we're going to act and we're going to act decisively, and then realizes that, no, they have no idea what they're going to be doing if we win it anyways, and then leaves, that basically abrogates the status quo in the region over to reactionary powers. And those two powers have been Iran and Russia. Now, it's interesting to note, Iran and Russia really don't have anything in common, except they benefit from current U.S. policy going away. So they have struck a very careful but very effective alliance in the region, where they use, again, mostly non-state forces to just wreck face all across the Middle East. And it's now at this point that Iran and the Saudi Arabia, who also hates Obama, and Russia, who also hates Obama, and the rebels, who also hate Obama, are negotiating a ceasefire in Syria and have not even invited the United States.
Yeah.
It's hubris, man. It's literal Greek tragedy shit that takes 25 years ago, America was literally striding across the world wherever it wanted to go, and now we can't even get invited to a Middle East peace conference.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Yeah.
And it's almost entirely domestically. You know, Russia didn't cause us to be weak. It just took advantage of our... It's a reactionary government. And they do so because they've already collapsed. Paradoxically, collapsing in the 90s made them lose all of their... or fire all of their hubristic people. And Putin wakes up every morning, realizes that Russia is a much weaker state in almost all respects than the United States, and just waits for the United States to do some schizophrenic, you know, bullshit that we're that we've done for the past 15 years and takes advantage of it. So as far as tactics goes, that's Russian foreign policy. They want it. They want a buffer state around them so that they don't get fucked with.
Yeah.
And we're not communicating that we're kind of cool with that, honestly. I mean,
yeah,
you know, Russia even went as far as after September 11th, they gave us permission to set up military bases in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan so we could go and invade Afghanistan. Now, think about what I just said for the past like hour and a half about Russia
security,
not wanting people around, you know, and now they're giving the United States military the prime mover of NATO, who they hate being on their western border, you know, and the reason for that is the second thing that Russia wants, and that is a complete elimination of political Islam. And this is the key to potential future America-Russia cooperation. Russia is at this moment 18% Muslim by population. They were about 10% Muslim when the Soviet Union disappeared, but Russian birth rate is massively more so than ethnic Russian birth rate. And It is an immense, ongoing, ever-present, almost intractable problem for Russia to solve. In a way, like if illegal Mexican immigrants had a propensity to blow themselves up one out of every 10,000 times people were over here, that gives you kind of a sample of what look like. Yeah. And so when we were talking about our war on terror, Russia was busy fighting the Second Chechen War, which was probably the most brutal war they fought since World War II. I think it beats out their adventure in Afghanistan for just sheer nihilistic depravity and brutality and bitterness on both sides. And so, I mean, Raqqa, the Islamic State's capital, is closer to Russian borders than Mexico City is to Texas.
Yeah.
It is a very short hop, skip, and a jump from the deadliest area in the world right now to southern Russia, which is where the Chechen War took place to begin with. And so when you talk about Russia not wanting to get fucked with, and you've got a restive underclass, because they are an underclass, they've been excluded from so much shit in Russian society because of their propensity to just call Shahad and want to be their own religio-ethnic state, regardless if it's the Tatars or the Chechens or the Dagestanis or whoever. I mean, this shit's been going on for millennia. Russia, in a way that is much more visceral and much more brutal than the United States is probably ever going to be on the topic of political Islam or jihad in general, just wants this current wave, this postmodernist, destroy all nation states wave of ideological fervor coming out of the Arab states to just drown in its own blood.
Yeah.
And they're committed in a way that even only the most fanatical CIA agents are in our case. And there's really not a whole lot of friction between the U.S. view and the Russian view on, in that regard. I mean, you'll even see it in some of our diplomatic channels. Like, you know, a U.S. diplomat will be talking to a Russian diplomat, and they'll all be sitting back, and they'll cross their arms, and they're talking about, you know, the economy, and they're talking about Eastern Europe, and they're talking about Ukraine, and they're talking about Syria, and you know, these guys just not getting it. And then they'll talk about counterterrorism, and oh my God, the conversation just opens up.
Yeah.
Because basically, it's like two guys that habitually butt heads, and then a third guy comes in, they both hate, and it's like, hold on 1 second. And they both just fuck him, you know? Yeah. Fuck him, man. Yeah. You know? We both countries have suffered thousands of deaths at the hands of terrorists. Mm-hmm. Russia still has terrorists every day. Russia just stopped, like literally this week, three separate attacks to blow up Russian train stations over New Year's. Mm. They're probably still going to have one happen tonight.
Mm.
And they just know that just sheer numbers means one of them is going to get through.
Mm.
Imagine being that guy.
Yeah.
The commander of Russian interior intelligence, knowing that you've got a sizable percentage of what is being close to 20% of your country that wants to blow up the other 80%.
Mm-hmm.
And if you try and just kill the entire problem, now you're a war criminal.
Yeah.
This is part of what I mean by Russia is never going to view things from a Western, industrialized, educated, rich, democratic perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the primary drivers on the ground in the Middle East are anti-state or non-state actors, and the primary drivers of those are political Islam.
Mm-hmm.
That's not something that's going to go away because state structures in the Middle East are so weak, economic prospects are so dismal, the populations are so large that that's just not going to go away. And one of the prime areas that we can really solve a whole lot of our problems in the Middle East and even get on Russia's good side is just stop supporting Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of our problems are that the United States is so bloated and so stuck in so many historical quagmires that we don't have any room to maneuver.
Mm-hmm.
So even though Russia's this tiny little nippy chihuahua, he can always get at our blind spots and he can always just nip away a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so if what America needs to do is not exactly go isolationist, but it is to examine in detail every single one of its current, obligations and realize which one of them actually benefits us, which one of them don't. If they do benefit us, we need to figure out exactly how it benefits us. Could it be better? But then save those. And then for all the ones that don't, either figure out how to change them so they do benefit us or just cut them out entirely. Because we're not in a position anymore to eat the costs of being everywhere at once.
Yeah.
For the past 70 years we have been, we are not anymore. And honestly, I think that's a good thing. Because if we had to keep in mind our weaknesses as well as our strengths, well, now we're back into Russia territory. And we're a lot stronger than Russia. So if we start meeting them strength for strength and avoiding our weaknesses while exploiting theirs, Russia's not that big of a deal.
Yeah.
Russia's not even like top five foreign policy things for me right now.
Yeah.
Russia is top 10 things that needs to get done over the next 10 years for American foreign policy, but it doesn't, I mean, it's compared to China and all the myriad things that they're doing, compared to immigration and the deleterious effects of not only what was done, but how it was done in this country, and how much, I'm serious when I say this, potential bloodshed there could be because of that.
Mm-hmm.
All Russia can do is take advantage of what we're already doing wrong. They can't cause either of those problems.
Yeah.
By rights, Russia should be fighting China. They don't have anything in common, aside from the fact that they both loathe and despise, but do not fear the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're willing to ally themselves mm-hmm. in order to be something. The third thing is exactly what I was just saying, and that is the Russo-Chinese border.
Mm-hmm.
Siberia is about to be one of the last great untapped resource areas in the world, and mm-hmm. they're already getting soft invaded by China.
Mm-hmm.
When Russia collapses again, a large part of that is going to be because they can no longer control the interior lines inside Siberia, and at that point it's going to be the Wild West. Mm-hmm. And you're going to see the United States take advantage of that real quick and start supporting deep state Russian interests in order to be a northern bulwark against China, because China's going to have a lot of domestic problems of its own. What I'm talking about is this is going to be about the 2026, 2030, 2034 area
mm-hmm.
right then. We're talking about 10 to 15 years from now.
Yeah,
which you know, for you and I is a long time. For nation state standards, it's right around the corner. People already mm-hmm. know this is going to happen. And if we can convince Russia that the United States is not out to get them, if we can convince Russia that there is an alternative to simply being lockstep allied with China, even as China begins to eat them like a parasite, then we have perhaps we can do a reverse Nixon to China moment.
Hmm.
Where in the 70s, Nixon went to China to split them off from the Soviet Union. Now some future president can go to Moscow to split them off from Beijing.
Hmm.
And that would be a bigger coup than beating them in battle ever would be. That mm-hmm. would be a bigger coup than replacing Assad ever could hope to be.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to have a really, really good view of what our interests are versus what theirs are.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to convince them that allying with us, even temporarily, mm-hmm. versus the Chinese, who are there right now.
Yeah.
You know, in 2016 was the first year that more Russian women in Siberia married ethnic Chinese men than ethnic Russian men.
Hmm.
Think about that for a second.
Yeah.
And Russia's got 200 million more men in their country than women.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you think all of these guys are going to go?
Yeah.
They're going to go to Malaysia. They're going to go to Pakistan. They're going to go to China. Not mm-hmm. all of them, but a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how expansionist powers get started.
Yeah.
And Russia hates that. Russia fears that. It's the exact same thing that they fear NATO for.
Mm-hmm.
But they fear NATO more than they fear China right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because China, when they come, also offers money and also offers power and also shares intelligence and also buys things from Russia, like military intelligence and military technology. So Russia's not getting nothing out of the deal, but Russia's basically facing the same decision geopolitically as American voters face domestically.
Mm-hmm.
Their choices are between something that they view as always bad and something that they view as potentially bad but potentially quite good, and fuck the U.S. anyways, and so they're choosing the Donald Trump option, which is ally with China, versus the option that they should get, which is do what's best for the Russian people.
Mm-hmm.
And the United States could be that country to offer them that in as little as 8 years.
Mm.
But it means that we have to get our own house in order first. So to sum this up, Russian foreign policy is get a buffer zone because they know they're weak and they know they're going to be weaker and they fear being weak.
Mm-hmm.
Take advantage of cracks appearing in Western media and populations. If China starts to crack, you'll see them take advantage of that too. They're not being partisan here. They're being scared and they're being savvy. And the third is find allies wherever you can and use them as much as physically possible to try and hurry up step number one, which is get a bulwark together, or stave off as much of your bulwark as possible from being shaved away, so that when the bad times come again, you're not at the mercy of the wolves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. Hopefully, that on the day that those meetings occur, Donald Trump has spoken to the right people.
I don't think that those meetings are going to occur when Donald Trump is president. I think the ideal situation is Donald Trump only serves one term. And the reason I say that is Donald Trump was elected to do domestic shit. He wasn't elected to be the foreign policy mm-hmm. president. In fact, the reason that foreign policy existed at all is because foreign policy, for the first time in a generation, was now having an effect on domestic matters in the United mm-hmm. States. That did not happen in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
We could do whatever we wanted in the 90s, and it had no effect whatsoever, which is why we did mm-hmm. a lot of the stuff we did. You should hear some of the conspiracy theories in the Balkans, by the way, about why the United States got involved in the Balkans in the first place. Mm. Because a lot of the people in the Balkans literally can't come up with a good reason why we did it. Because they can't view it from the weird... We saw people dying, and in the 90s, we figured the world was past that point. Mm-hmm. So we were going to just... We were going to stop that.
Yeah.
And that's literally the reason why we did it. Mm-hmm. It was just that. It was a knee-jerk, oh my God, the people... And then that was it. And the rest of the world literally just did not see it that way. So the convoluted conspiracy theories they try and get to square that circle are hilarious if you can see both sides. The Russians are never going to have that type of good faith argument with Donald Trump because they don't have good faith in Donald Trump. They feel like they have him pinned as a buffoonish, clownish, would-be strongman who's not as smart as he thinks he is, and they're just going to tell him what he wants to hear and then go behind his back. Mm-hmm. And for about 80% of that, I think they have him pegged pretty well.
Yeah.
When Trump wises up that that's what they're doing, I feel like you could actually see a really sudden worsening of relations with Russia because he realizes that they are my friend! Yeah! I'm not trying to say Trump's an idiot, but Trump just doesn't care.
Yeah.
Trump is not going to do the type of introspection necessary to figure out Russian duplicity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, ironically, basically just taking a step back like Trump wants to do is going to indirectly be of a good benefit for the United States because it allows the domestic conversation, exactly like what you and I are having, to happen. Mm-hmm. If Hillary Clinton was president, that conversation couldn't take place because she had already decided that Russia was bad and that was just how it was going to be because it helps her domestically. Again, both of these are entirely self-serving. And so if the United States public and nation as a whole can have this conversation to the extent that whoever comes or whatever comes after Donald Trump can have policies in place to start dealing forthrightly with Russia, we have nothing to fear from Russia.
Mm-hmm.
But if we don't, then Russia, along with almost every other country and every other group of people around the world, is going to continue to exploit our differences and exploit the ever-growing disconnect between large parts of American society until eventually American society tears itself apart.
Mm-hmm.
But this also means this is entirely our problem to fix or our problem to lose. Russia's not in the driver's seat here.
Yeah.
Russia's simply the best backseat driver in the world right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically where things lay.
Yeah. That's awesome. Some, like, very broad and not very, like... I know that you like getting into the details of stuff.
I do.
But I'm going to, like... ask you to pull back and just kind of give some more broad answers here. What do you think is the biggest foreign problem regarding the United States?
The fact that we don't have a good idea of what our interests are.
Mm.
I mean, it really is that broad. We can't, for Europe, for Russia, for China, for Mexico, for Canada, for the Caribbean, we don't have a good idea of what we want to keep from what's worked. We don't even have a good idea of what's worked or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you talk to someone inside Washington, they're going to say, oh, the Washington consensus is great. If you talk to someone in Detroit, they're going to vehemently disagree with that.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not even talking to each other on that respect. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the United States is not united.
Yeah.
That's the biggest, that's the root of most of our problems right there.
Yeah. And then what do you think is the foreign power that we should probably be most concerned about?
China. China. Because they do a lot of the same things Russia does, but they're a lot more powerful themselves.
Mm.
And they have the ability over the next 10 years to make some really systemic, which means slow moving, which means they're probably not going to get the same headlines as, oh my God, Russian hacks would, that completely change the power in the Western Pacific that we're never going to get a chance to change again if that happens. Also, China's big enough that if they start having domestic problems, like if Russia collapses tomorrow, then Eastern Europe goes to shit. They can have the ability to turn the Middle East into a slaughterhouse even more than it already is, but they're not going to bring the world down with it.
Mm-hmm.
If Russia starts if China has some serious internal divisions that really pop out of the open, they have the ability to bring the world down with them when they go. And I'm not talking about nuclear hellfire type stuff. I just mean, you know, finance flows and manufacturing capability and just hundreds of millions of refugees if that happens. It's just
no
a nightmare.
No more cheap-ass toys.
Basically, yeah. I mean, the ability to transfer over Chinese ability to make shit, and it's not even cheap shit at this point. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, cheap toys are now made in Malaysia. They're now made in Bangladesh. They're not made, you know, McDonald's is switching over from Manchuria to Malaysia.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're talking about about world steel output. Now we're talking about world transistor output, things that there's just not an analog in the rest of the world for. And if they go tits up, or if they go more aggressive than they are, that's something that the United States needs to be able to counter or to take advantage of or to forestall in the first place. But again, that means the United States needs to get a clear head without having cold feet or a cold heart. And it cannot do that right now.
Yeah.
And I honestly think Donald Trump isn't going to help in that regard, but he is going to forestall the absolute worst-case scenario of somewhat just as unwilling to compromise, but much more, in my opinion, actively evil, holding the Oval Office. And so we're reaching a blend point where to solve foreign problems, you need to solve domestic foreign policy, and solving domestic foreign policy would go a long ways towards solving foreign policy, because it's always easier to fix things here than to try and go across and meet Russia head-to-head in some type of hybrid war, because they're going to be better at it than us right now.
Yeah. Cool. For some reason, I was kind of expecting – well, regardless, how do you feel that the radical Islam problem is – in the long-term or short-term point of view?
Okay. I think that as far as the Middle East goes, which is, you know, the hotbed of radical Islam and political Islam, we have to realize that Russia holds the strong cards in this for probably the better part of the next 10 years. Our foreign policy there has just failed so abjectly that trying to wade back in with the limited resources we're capable of bringing to bear is just not going to be effective, and we're better served by pulling back, coming up with something different, and then re-engaging, which is exactly what Russia did, which is why they're in such a strong situation right now. Russia didn't choose to do that. That was chosen for them, and they just played their hands as best they could, and better than us in this regard. As far as radical Islam goes, the ideal situation for me would be basically to realize that state-based systems in the Middle East are increasingly becoming irrelevant, and to proceed accordingly. I'm not sure the United States can even do that at the moment, though, because the United States is the guarantor of the state system. As at least large parts of the U.S. elite want to transition the state system into a globalist system, and I oppose that for several reasons which aren't germane to this conversation. But as things stand right now, the United States is much, much more heavily a defender of the nation state than Russia. Because, again, Russia has already collapsed. Russia is a decentralized state that is very, very willing to use the mafia or recently retired Russian soldiers fighting as mercenaries whose money just happens to come from the Russian government to go do things. Or patriotic hackers, or, you know, to just directly work with groups like Hezbollah or groups like the Iranian Revolutionary Guard on the ground in Syria, which much better matches the reality on the ground. And so to deal with radical Islam, you have to deal with the reasons why radical Islam is currently so popular, and that is the absolute failure of every other type of government and economic structure in the Middle East to give people any hope of what they want.
Yeah.
And that is a very, very difficult Gordian knot to untie, and I think we're just going to end up having – we're going to have to slice it. But I think a large part of that is that we're so caught up in our old 20th century vintage alliances that we can't cut out our own bad actors. Again, I'm gonna plug this. If we basically went to Saudi Arabia and we're like, dude, here's a laundry list of things you need to stop fucking up on, or we're just gonna throw you to the wolves.
Yeah.
Saudi Arabia's going to throw a shit fit, but what are they going to do?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Alone, they can't even take on Iran, much less Russia. Yeah. In fact, alone, they can't even take on Yemen, much less Iran. They're a rentier state, and they're exporting their bad apples, and that's a large part of what's driving this the most radical, Wahhabi and Salafist ideology around the globe. And that's being taken advantage of by places like Iran and Russia. And so a large part of this is basically just getting to a situation where the United States can build on their strengths rather than getting taken advantage of on their weaknesses, and then make compromises for make compromises that would, you know, give the best result possible in the Middle East. Now, notice I didn't say that we're ever going to fix that, because I don't think we're going to. I think this is going to be a generational thing in the Middle East. These have been building for so long. The population bulges are so large there. The resource shortages are so acute there that I really don't see the ability for the region not to be inflamed for a long time to come. Mm-hmm. The primary thing that the United States and Russia needs to do is to contain it. Is to prevent it from spreading.
Yeah.
And this would be things like making sure Egypt doesn't fall, making sure if Lebanon does go over the brink that it doesn't spread, making sure that Lebanon doesn't go over the brink, shoring up Jordan and making sure that it doesn't go over. Maybe even potentially letting Iraq soft bifurcate into Sunnistan and Shiistan and Kurdistan, and so that there's not this constant battle for supremacy among there. Making sure that large numbers of Muslims aren't allowed to come into, you know, countries where they can start breaking apart the social contract. And I'm not just talking about Western Europe here. I'm talking about places like Africa, where hundreds of thousands of people from as far away as Syria or even Afghanistan are now, you know, forming mosques. Yeah. And because there's nothing in common between a Kenyan and an Afghan, they form these insular communities that are ripe for jihadist thinking. And so that's going to be something that I'm going to be watching over the past, you know, over the future decade, is like an Afghan insurgency in Kenya. Welcome to the 21st century.
Yeah.
But really just to cut that area off and let it be its own bloody failed state, and to only go in there, really to make it a quarantine zone, and to only go in there when we are using our strengths and we have really well-defined reasons for being there. And if we don't. No good comes of it. So that'd be the primary way for the Middle East, is just to cut it off.
Yeah.
And to use other state actors that are closer to them than us, people like Iran or Jordan or Israel or Russia, for that matter, because Russia's always going to have a better, like a more immediate vested interest in making sure political Islam isn't a rising force in the world than we are, because we've got the Atlantic Ocean in the way. They don't.
Yeah.
Russia literally has plans to nuke the Middle East if it gets that bad. I am not kidding.
Yeah.
They really view this as an existential thing. We don't. And so we have the ability to basically compose ourselves, to take, you know, a break from for a failed foreign policy, and to come back on our own terms, only focusing on our strengths and mitigating or eliminating a lot of our weaknesses.
Yeah. That's okay. It's kind of funny because, like, I bring all this stuff up not to concern people, just because, like, all these talks about, like, oh, the future looks kind of scary with Russia and, like, but at the same time, I feel as though it's good to be informed,
right?
But don't be like paralyzed.
Well, I think the last thing I would say is that realism is optimism, in that the absolute best results, like truly happy results, truly 20 years from now, can't believe I thought it was that bad results, are only going to happen if we take a very realistic view and just hold steady to a just realism. And I'm convinced that if push comes to shove and you know, the people who are in politics in America, of regardless of who they are, really come to understand that those are the stakes, that's exactly what's going to happen. So I'm not an alarmist. I mean, I've seen the stats. I mean, I know that the world is for the first time in a century, or excuse me, the first time in 40 years, getting more violent year over year over year. That's a huge change that I don't think is going away anytime soon. Inequality in the world is skyrocketing, and that's partially what's driving that. But I'm not despondent. You know, I think that the chances are good. They're not. It's not a sure thing by any means, but the chances are good that that the world as a whole will weather this.
Yeah.
That Russia will weather this. That the United States will weather this. Russia at the moment doesn't even trust the United States enough that if Russia were to get into some serious trouble with political Islam, like if there was if Chechnya repeated itself and there was an area of Russia that literally fought the Soviet army or Russian army to a standstill, and Russia needed help to take it back, I'm not even sure they'd ask us at the moment, mm-hmm. even for air support or intel gathering, because things really are that bad. If we can fix that, I mean, Russia's always going to be an adversary. Mm-hmm. I said this at the very beginning. Russia's always going to have some wishes that are just diametrically opposed to the United States. Mm-hmm. But in a lot of areas, we share a lot of similarities. Mm-hmm. And if we focus on those and work our hardest to basically make compromises, and one of the things that the United States government needs to understand, the current neoliberal slash neoconservative slash end of history crowd needs to understand, is that compromise is not restating what you want in a different way. Mm-hmm. Compromise means both sides get some of what they want and neither side gets all of what they want.
Yeah.
And if we really do that... Mm-hmm. then I think that a lot of doors that are currently closed, barred, and locked to us are going mm-hmm. to, you know, creak open just a little yeah. bit. And if we can get our foot in the door there and then show not even good faith, but just good sense,
yeah.
then I really don't see a problem.
Yeah. I thought of two other points to make, but it would also stem into, like, an entirely different conversation. This one
has sure.
already been going. But I at least want to get a very summed up, I guess, hypothesis out that do you think that if we were to solve some of our corporatocracy oligarchical problems domestically, that would solve quite a bit of our domestic issues?
Oh, definitely. I think that, and again, I'm not going to go into detail here because that is something that I really want to talk about on its own thing. Mm-hmm. It is just forget the rest of the world. Let's talk about what a perfectly strengthened America for the first half of the 21st century would look like. Mm-hmm. But yeah, a large part of it is just the fact that the winners in America win disproportionately. Mm-hmm. There are a very short list, and it's growing shorter, of those that do win, mm-hmm. and the winners aren't doing anything to help the losers.
Yeah.
So if that goes on for long enough, then eventually the losers are going to realize that they have nothing more to lose, and now that's how the bloody summer of 1919 mm-hmm. breaks out. And so, yeah, I mean, there's the America right now is divided, but it's also moribund. Mm-hmm. And it part of, you know, half of itself despises the other half, and if you continue down that road long enough, no good comes of it.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, you know, right now we're so divided that we're one bad economic crisis away from literally having insurgencies pop up in the yeah. country. Now, Russia would be like, what's this problem? Because they've had an insurgency in their country for the past, like, ever, and they're already doing all of this other shit because Russia understands that they're a decentralized state. Mm-hmm. Washington doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, Washington's knee-jerk reaction is, how dare they? We're America, goddammit, and then send in whoever.
Yeah.
And if that fails, then we have a crisis of government because America is a stronger state conceptually than the Soviet Union ever was. The Soviet Union was the aftermath of a revolution followed by a civil war.
Yeah.
We were a revolution with a much delayed civil war, which clarified the original revolution and did not further change things. And we've been stable for the past 150 years. Mm-hmm. Russia's had the second deadliest civil war of the 20th century, followed by the two deadliest wars of the 20th century, followed by threatening with nuclear holocaust, followed almost immediately after that by political Islamic mm-hmm. insurgency. And that's Russian history over the past 100 years.
Also the biggest genocide in human history.
No, that would still be Mao.
Ah, well,
that would still be the Cultural Revolution.
I don't remember the numbers on that.
Talking about the Holodomor or the Holocaust or whatever?
The Stalin's...
Purges?
Yeah.
Because that's number two. Mm. But still, out of the four greatest purges slash genocides of the 20th century, three of them either happened on Russian soil or because of Russian soil, and the other one was their neighbor.
Yeah.
So this brings it back to the whole bad neighborhood that they live in type of thing. So yeah, it's... So...
Yeah. Corey, thank you for doing this conversation
with me. Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure.
Where can we find the stuff that you're making?
Honestly, most of the stuff that I write is for internal consumption. I am writing... for War on the Rocks, and for the Syrian Civil War subreddit honestly got taken over because so many, this is going to be really ironic, Russian chatbots took over the sub that I actually stood down as a mod of it because we were getting so much just pure bullshit thrown at. I mean, literal Russian shills. Yeah. And so I hope that when whoever's hearing this doesn't take me to be like a Russophile who wants the U.S. to wants the Russia to win at the expense of the U.S. It's not that. I just really disagree with a lot of the things that the U.S. is currently doing, and I don't see them as beneficial to anyone except for the direct people making the decisions that I don't really consider to be pro-America at this point. And so when I see Russian chatbots, which are different from Russian hackers, these are basically either unemployed Russians or Russian high schoolers after school who are getting paid pennies on the dollar to shitpost and just smear shit all over the wall so nobody can get a good picture of what's going on.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to deal with them. And so now I'm at a place called Craft of Intelligence on Reddit. And I'm also writing for War on the Rocks and doing, you know, other freelance stuff. I'm also collecting some of the stuff that I've written together to start a blog. And that's going to be what I'm going to plug from there on out. So you can really just get pure unadulterated me.
Yeah.
if there is such a thing as unadulterated me. And as far as that, you know, that's going on, that's what I'm doing. So.
Cool. Awesome. And I'm Santiago Ramones. You can find all the stuff that I do on my website, santiagoramones.com. I also make music, which you can listen to. You can review this podcast on iTunes. Hopefully it's a good review and that bumps me up somewhere higher to where more people can enjoy this show and this awesome, crucially important conversation, I think.
Yeah.
I always end every podcast with my three things, which is love never fails, it's going to be okay, I might be wrong. Thanks for listening.